Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started, and if people keep streaming in, that's fine. So welcome, everyone. Great to have you all here today when you had such lovely weather and options of other things. So why don't we take just a minute to settle our minds and to sort of think about why we came, set an intention for spending these couple hours together. And just think of whatever brought you here, and of course, the highest intention is to work on our own minds so that we can ultimately be of greatest benefit to others. Eventually lead them all the way to enlightenment. Okay. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Chuki, and you're in the right place if you're expecting a workshop on grief and loss. Otherwise, check your ticket and go back to the gate. Anne and I have talked quite a bit, and I'll introduce her in a moment, but we've talked quite a bit about really wanting to create a safe space here as much as we can, knowing this is being streamed and being recorded, and, you know, so keep that in mind if there's anything that you're not comfortable sharing with the greater audience, and you probably don't want to share it because this is public, but really, you know, this is a difficult topic for all of us in different ways, and so it's great that we're looking at it, and I'm really rejoicing that y'all are here, but just make sure you're taking care of yourself. So if it might be useful even now while things are sort of objective to think about if you're having a tough time with things that come up today, what might you do about that? You know, when you go home, do you have somebody you could call, or do you have a process that you usually do when things are difficult? Just to have that in your back pocket in case you leave here and you find yourself a little surprised at having some difficult emotions, because we want this to be helpful, not to be harmed. So we will pass a mic around just because there are people online watching, and so they won't be able to hear if we don't have that. So... Right, they can't, right. Yeah, they won't be able to see you, but if you don't have the mic, they also won't be able to hear you, and that makes it less of a quality experience for the people online. is there anybody here at the center for the first time? Everybody's been here before? Okay, great, so you all know where the restrooms are. Okay, so we definitely want this to be informal, so feel free to just come and go as you need to, and the restrooms are just out the door to the left. We probably won't take a break, but we'll just sort of see how people are doing. And we'll try to end right at 3 o'clock. So I'm just going to do a very brief introduction to this topic from a Buddhist perspective. And then this is Anne Marsland, and she is a grief counselor at Horizons Grief Center, which is part of Hospice of Wake County, and she'll say more about that in just a minute. But Anne's been fantastic in working with me so that we could sort of meld Western perspectives on grief with Buddhist perspectives. So I'm going to do just a quick little topic, throwing out some Buddhist terms that usually come around this topic, and then she'll be talking some of the Western ones, and then we'll do sort of this back and forth. So we definitely want things to be informal. Feel free to ask questions, jump in. You know, we're a small group, so that makes it really nice. So basically, from a Buddhist perspective, really what, a key piece of understanding grief is understanding impermanence, right? It's just that everything changes, and we experience grief when it's a big sudden change or when it's something we really didn't want to change, you know. Keeping impermanence in mind can sometimes help be an antidote, and even if it's not a full antidote, it can at least make the bitter pill easier to swallow, so to speak. So, we'll talk a little bit perhaps later about, you know, really looking at how do things change. I mean, really getting in mind that, yeah, that's really true. It's not just a pithy little thing that's always thrown out at these Buddhist talks. Also, of course, there's attachment involved with grief, because if we weren't attached to what we were losing, it wouldn't be hard to lose it. So who can remember a definition of attachment? Susie, would you mind grabbing the mic to pass it around? I know some of you know, but it's always hard to be the first one. I've heard some of you answer it before in this very room.
Exaggerating the qualities of an object.
Yeah, so exaggerating the positive qualities. That's the definition of attachment from a Buddhist point of view. So, you know, we can really think about that when we're first falling in love, right? Because that person is perfect. There's just nothing wrong, you know. And then over time we maybe shift that a little bit. But, you know, it's that sense of really exaggerating the positive. And so, you know, when we have that with that clinging sense of really wanting it, then when it's gone, of course, there's a real sense of loss around that. So just keep in mind as we're talking today about attachment, where you find yourself attached, because we all have our different ways that we do that, and think about ways that you might be able to shift that to make things easier for yourself. And, of course, the opposite of attachment isn't detachment. It's not saying being cold and non-feeling, right? It's non-attachment. It's being able to roll with not getting that object of desire, whether it's, you know, the chocolate cake or the pizza or the perfect guy, whatever it is. So, and then the third idea I want to keep in mind that's a Buddhist idea for today's talk is interdependence. This idea that even when we experience the loss of having, say, a person in our life or the loss of the job and the way we expected it or the loss of a role that we have for ourselves, you know, whatever the loss is that we experience, there's still this way that being interacting with that up until now has shaped us. There's been this interdependence going on. And so it's not a complete loss, right? It's not the same as if that had never existed or been part of our experience. And so sometimes keeping that in mind can be a helpful way to process the loss, is to realize, well, it's not a complete loss. It's not everything. It's just some things. So, again, we'll talk more about that as we go along. But I just wanted to give a preview of the three main concepts to keep in mind as we're trying to meld that with some of the Western ones we're going to talk about. So.
Sure.
Okay, so this is Anne Marsland. Welcome,
yes.
Anne.
Thank you. I'm not sure that this is on. Or
yeah.
Maybe it is on. Okay.
Is everybody here okay?
This is a treat for me because I have a very soft-spoken voice, so it's strange having it amplified in this way. And I'm glad you can hear me. I hope you can hear me in the back. Okay. My name's Anne, and as Chuki mentioned, I work at Horizons Grief Center, which is just a couple of miles from here, off of Trinity Road. And some of you may be familiar. We're part of Hospice of Wake County, and I'm a clinical social worker. I actually used to work in the field as a hospice social worker, working with terminally ill patients and their families, and have been doing that for about 7 years, and really just in the past year did I move down to the grief center, kind of the other side of things. There are six of us at the center, six counselors. I work with adults, and we have two counselors who also work with children. And basically we provide counseling support to adults who are coping with a loss. In our case, it's a loss related to death, not, although there are lots of other types of losses. And we provide individual counseling as well as support groups, workshops like this in the community, and some workshops we have at the center and different memorial services around holiday times. I do have some information brochures over there if you're interested when we finish knowing more about the center. There's also a sign-up sheet if you want to be included. We're trying to move into the 21st century at the center, so if you would like to be added to our listserv, basically our email list, feel free to include your contact information there. And we do send out information about upcoming workshops and different events if you're ever interested in that. So we're hoping that you'll come away from this workshop with hopefully a broader understanding of grief and the grieving process and a deeper understanding. 2 hours is not enough, not enough. And at the same time, it's a long time to sit with such a heavy topic. And I meant to say just thank you for even putting on this workshop, and thank you for giving up a beautiful Saturday afternoon to come and really face into a topic that most of us would rather not even think about. So it says a lot that you're here, and I just want to admire and acknowledge your courage in being here. And I want to say, too, that this may be an opportunity to have some new insights into your own personal losses, whether you're currently dealing with fresh grief or even old losses that are still a part of you at this time. Most of what I know about grief and understand about grief comes, of course, from my own personal experiences with loss, but really it's from sitting with people who are grieving. They're my best teachers. Just I've learned so much just in having the privilege of being able to hear their stories and hear their struggles and hear their courage. So I know that you guys are going to teach me a lot today as well. I'm a very informal presenter. I'm much more confident in a one-on-one setting, so I'm sure that's obvious, but I appreciate you working with me, and we'll try to have this be as interactive as possible. We're both pretty informal, and I really don't want this to be a lecture, so we'll try to have it be as much give and take as you're all comfortable doing, and feel free if you have questions to, as Shuki said, to just raise your hand or stop me, or if there's something you want to share, I really welcome that. That being said, please only share what you're comfortable sharing. Of course, I take confidentiality really seriously, but I know this is being streamed, so there are limits to that confidentiality. So practice good self-care, and you all know that means different things to each of you in this room. But one thing that would help me before we go much further is just to kind of have a sense of who's in the room. And we don't necessarily need to go around the room, but I'm wondering if, for those of you who are comfortable raising your hands, if you've ever experienced a significant loss in your life of someone that you care about. Yeah, it's kind of what I expected. For those of you who raised your hands, which I think was pretty much everyone in the room, were any of those losses in the past year? Okay. Any in the past couple of months, past 6 months? Okay. Thank you. Are any of you currently serving as a caregiver for someone with an illness? Okay. Sort of, yeah. Anyone here currently facing a life-limiting illness? Okay. Thank you. Just want to get a sense of who's here today. I told you we were going to be interactive, so we'll kind of get right to that. I have an exercise that I want to walk you through that's kind of experiential. And its purpose is really just to help you kind of bring to the surface the feelings and thoughts that may be a part of the experience of grief. For any of you in the room who are currently grieving a recent loss, or maybe not even necessarily a recent loss, this exercise can be kind of heavy. And I just, again, want to encourage the self-care piece. And if you don't feel comfortable participating, certainly don't feel obliged to. Just participate at whatever level is comfortable for you. And we'll have an opportunity to sort of debrief and talk about what the exercise was like when we finish. Shuki's going to help me hand out some slips of paper, and looks like most of you have writing utensils, but I think we have some if needed. You should all have 9 slips of paper, and hopefully I can still count. You each have 9. Did everyone? A couple more? Oh. All right. We weren't sure how many people were going to be here this morning, so this afternoon. So what I'm going to ask you to do is, on the pieces of paper, let's start by take 3 slips of paper and one per each slip, write down the names of 3 people who are currently in your life, people who are still alive, who you consider very important to you.
The one name per slip.
Yes. Yeah. And they should be people who are still alive, one name per slip. You can just look up at me when you're finished so I'll know to give you the next instruction. And take your time. Give you just another minute. Can be hard to choose just 3. Yeah. Yes. Yes. The exercise is about to get interesting. So, all right. You'll need 3 more slips of paper, and again, one thing per slip. And this time, I'm going to ask you to put down 3 activities that you enjoy doing. Activities that energize you or that you're passionate about. Could be running, knitting, reading, whatever it is, the activities that are meaningful to you. Take just another minute, those of you who are still riding. And hopefully you all have 3 slips left. If you need more, we have more back here. And the last invitation is to write down 3 things, 3 qualities about yourself that you feel pretty good about, that you really like and value about yourself. These can be tangible. They can be intangible. It could be your curly hair. It could be your sense of humor, your compassion, whatever those qualities are that are part of you that are really important aspects of yourself that you admire about yourself. There's no right or wrong way to do this. Try not to overthink it. And as you finish, maybe just put the slips of paper in front of you so you can see those people, those activities, those qualities that you've drawn attention to. Has everybody had a chance to, anybody still working on getting that done? All right. So now I'm going to tell you a story. Before I do that, I'm supposed to invite you to reflect on the importance of these people, these activities, these qualities that you see before you. Think about the good memories and experiences, the joy, the energy that these people and these activities, and these qualities bring you. Now I'm going to tell you a story. And it's a hypothetical story, obviously. But it's a story about you. So let's imagine it's a beautiful fall day, kind of like today. And you've worked hard and played hard all day long, and you're feeling pretty good about yourself and about your life. Then you head home at the end of the day and decide to take a warm shower to unwind before heading to bed. And as you're drying yourself off after your shower, you notice something new. It's a lump where one should not be. It's small, but it's painful. And you feel a surge of fear in your gut. You try to brush it off, thinking that you're just imagining it to be there. But you find you can't sleep much that night. You keep wondering about that lump. You try to keep positive, but despite your efforts, the lump continues to enlarge and it becomes more painful. And it's harder and harder to ignore it. You keep putting off going to the doctor because that's what we do, right? We put things off. But you're anxious and you're worried, and eventually you tell a loved one about the lump and you call the doctor to make an appointment. And now it's time for you to give up one of your slips of paper. Shuki and I are going to actually come around and collect the papers in a basket. So I'm going to ask you to choose any one of those items and crumple it up, and Shuki and I will collect it. Whichever one. I mean, there are really no instructions beyond that. Just choose. I can come back to you if you need a moment. It's not easy to choose. It's not meant to be an easy exercise. So. Okay. So for the next several days, you are consumed by worry. Eventually, you find yourself in the doctor's waiting room. You're nervous. Your senses are heightened. You notice everything in the room, the ticking clock, the receptionist clicking her pen, the worn-out magazines, the fish tank gurgling air bubbles. You tell yourself you're making a big deal about nothing. Your name is called, and despite yourself, you jump a little. Your heart's beating faster now as the doctor takes a history, and you try to second guess why she's asking you all these questions. She assures you it's probably nothing, but she wants to run a few tests just to be sure. As the thoughts race through your mind, more loss and more fear occurs. And the doctor says we'll know the results of the tests by Friday. So we're going to come around with the baskets again and same directive, choose a slip of paper, crumple it up and place it in the basket as we come around. Any of the categories. It's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Those slips are gone. And I'm sorry if I said activities. I'll come back to you. She's already been around this way. Okay. It's random or it can be intentional. It's anyone still holding on to a slip? Thank you. Thank you. Someone's okay. So you get into your car to drive home, and it's two more days until Friday. And you try to keep your mind off of what might happen. But no matter how many other ways you try to distract yourself, you keep coming back to that lump. And you find yourself thinking about your family and your friends. There are a lot of what-ifs going through your head at this point. And the days pass slowly, and you don't get much sleep. Friday finally arrives, and the phone finally rings at 2 in the afternoon. And it's the nurse at the doctor's office. And she wants you to come in at 3:30. The doctor wants to speak with you herself. So you're worrying, of course, about what sort of news it is that the doctor, why can't she tell you over the telephone? But slowly and methodically, you prepare to go to the doctor's office. You find yourself feeling that lump. And it feels like it's grown even larger, even just in the past week. And now it's time to give up another slip of paper, another thing of value, any of the categories. Anyone still holding on to a slip? So you arrive at the doctor's exam room, and it's colder this time and feels sterile. You know how doctor's offices are kind of sterile. And the doctor examines the lump again, and she does some routine tests. And then asks you to dress and come to her office. You find your heart beating faster and your legs are kind of like rubber. And the doctor sits in a chair next to you and the words you've dreaded are finally spoken. I'm afraid I have some bad news for you. And then you can't remember all that the doctor says in the next few minutes. But the words cancer, surgery, chemotherapy and radiation stand out. And this time, I need for you to give up 2 slips of paper. Did we miss anyone? Thank you. So a week passes, and the doctor tells you the surgery went well, and she prescribes a mixture of radiation, chemotherapy. You take a leave of absence from your work responsibilities, and the doctor's vague about your recuperation, indicating it could be 6 to 8 months, but you press her, but she really won't be more specific than this. And during this time, you draw some strength from the support of your family and friends, and you're resolved with your decision to pursue treatment. And the first treatment leaves you drained physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. You wonder if you're going to be able to make it through even the first round of treatment. But you do. You try to make this time meaningful for a while. You're filled with hope. You have some good days when you feel your energy returning, and other days that are heavy and difficult. The friends that were so supportive at the time of your operation are eerily silent now, and it feels like they're avoiding you, like your disease is contagious or something. And you look in the mirror at your gaunt features, and you wonder if you'll ever look the same. You feel your life slipping away. Your body has lost a great deal of its energy, and activities have lost a lot of their pleasure. You start to have trouble getting to the bathroom, and you know what's coming now. Please give up another slip of paper, just one. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. So several months pass by, and somehow you know in your gut that you're not getting any better. And your doctor tells you that the treatments have worked as well as they can, but unfortunately your cancer has continued to grow and has now become larger than anyone can treat. And there's nothing left for curative medicine to do. And for the purposes of this activity, and this is a hypothetical activity, let's say that you elect to focus on comfort care at this point. And you're now confined to bed most of the time, and the yard outside is full of weeds, and the early signs of winter are coming on. Your family and friends come by more often now. And it begins to dawn on you that your death is nearing. And this time, Chuki and I are going to come around and we're going to select two more slips of paper from each of you. Our choice. My choice. Yeah, I'm not really going to look at them, but I'm just going to take them. Sure to get you. Thank you. Okay. Got it. She gets you already? So you wake up early one morning, and really you're not even sure if it's morning or night, and your breathing has become more labored, and you somehow sense that this may be your last day on this earth. You slip into a deep sleep. Your breathing becomes slower and more difficult. You awake to complete silence, stillness. You feel disoriented, not even sure where you are. You take a long, deep breath, holding it in, and then letting it go. You take another deep breath, hold it in, and let it go. This last breath was your last breath in this life. And you have passed from this life to whatever comes next. So I want to invite you to please crumple up your last, hopefully you have one last remaining piece of paper, and give away your last possession from this life. You have two left. Oh, you got a bonus. Okay. I want to ask you to all just take a deep breath now, because that was just a hypothetical exercise. You can have those slips of paper back at the end of the session if you want them. In reality, you haven't lost anything. But I appreciate you going through the exercise with me. I'm trying to get myself organized here. I just want to ask you, some of you may have done a version of this exercise before. Some of you, it may be unlike anything you've ever done. But I'm wondering what the experience was like for you. Any feelings that came up as you were doing the activity? If there's anyone that's comfortable sharing.
I think this was really interesting because I'm a hospice volunteer. Mm. So it gave me a real kind of concrete way to look what people are actually going through. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of this, you know, some of the things that people go to as they're dying, but if you're like, you know, switching places with them and now I'm in exactly their same place, gives you kind of a really new perspective on, sure. You know, the things that you can expect when they need help.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good.
It's a good point. Thank you. Thank you. In the back.
I, like Annie, I am a former hospice volunteer of many years. And for me personally, it was a very powerful exercise. In having family members presently who are going through exactly this,
yes.
It has brought home from being objective to almost like subjective in the feelings that they must be experiencing now, and also the feelings of the patients that I tried to help before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And seeing things that are important to you in your life being just sliding away, and from a Buddhist viewpoint, what are you left with at the very end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And thank you.
Not getting a choice. What was it like for you guys not getting a choice? The time when Chucky and I came around and just kind of willy-nilly took things.
Well, I think, again, you know, from the point of being a hospice volunteer, you can actually see what happens to the person because they are losing everything and they have no choice in what's going on.
Right.
And we will all be in that same position. You know, it may not be because somebody's coming up and taking the slips of paper, but, you know, as the person goes through the dying process, things just really slip away. And no matter how much you cling to it or want it to stay, it's gone. And it's kind of a very freeing experience to know that you're going to be okay without that in some cases, but in also in many cases it's extremely frightening for people to see that they are just actually not in touch, you know, with things that are very important to them.
Thank you. I'm wondering which things were hardest to part with for people, and that may be different responses depending on who you are. Behind you, Mary.
I actually, the comment about interdependence was so helpful, mm-hmm. because I started to see, my explorations of nature are in my sharings with my friend Bercidas, you know, or my simplicity is in something else. So in a way, the three qualities of myself, which I thought I would be hanging on to mm-hmm. till the end, maybe, mm-hmm. After three cycles, those actually I could let go of, because nobody can take them from me, including mm-hmm. myself. Mm-hmm. Nobody could steal them from me, mm-hmm. even. So after the first three, you know, I was struggling to, you know, what to give up now.
Yeah.
Then those next three almost became pretty easy, because the truth is nobody can steal them from me. Mm-hmm. And whatever goes on will carry it with it will be carried along in that stream. And then the last three, and then when you said, well, we're going to come around and take two, it was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, a little startling, but that was just like, well, that's part of the flow too, and that is the truth.
That is.
Thank you. That was a powerful exercise.
Yeah. Thank you.
I concur with her in regard to when we had the choice of if we had to let something go, we could make that choice. But then, as she said, when you came around and took the slips away, when we had absolutely no choice, I was grateful at the end for my one slip that was left there of being able to continue to help others.
That was your last slip.
That was my last slip.
Huh. How about that?
Yeah. May that be so.
Yes. Yeah. And in real life, of course, we don't get a choice how many things are taken away and when and how.
Yeah, I think I probably had a classic mom response. I mean, the two that Chucky took away were the two kids. And, you know, I realized I'm sitting here thinking now, this is going to be hardest on who, you know? So I'll leave that one to the end, because it'll be hardest on him or it'll be hardest on her.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it was more about how the loss, the constant loss, part of me is just like, okay, well, let's get through this quickly, because, you know, this is about losing. It's all going to go. So can we move on? Really, I mean, that's what I was feeling like.
Yeah.
I hope in reality I go quickly, because mm-hmm. let's move on to the next thing, because mm-hmm. none of it's going to stay.
Right. So.
Well, I had the opposite, so I thought it was funny. Being a planner, I saw it. I planned out what it would be.
You were on to me.
Yeah, no, I didn't know you were going to do it, so I had it worked out what I was going to be left with, what I thought, which I thought was going to be so helpful, you know, having a good mind.
What were you going to be left with?
A good mind.
A good mind.
Yeah. Just trying to be as virtuous as possible. And so she took my good mind.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of funny, because then I realized I can't know I'm going to have a good mind at all. So if I'm in a tremendous amount of pain and I'm on painkillers, that was really helpful to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, but that brought it home that mm-hmm. I can't control that. So that was really helpful, because I couldn't choose. So
yeah.
I would have been, if you didn't do that, I would have still kind of felt like, okay, you know, can roll with this, but that's not true. So that was good to shake that, I think.
And one of the things about this exercise that I think is so powerful is we're always talking about how do you get it from your head to your heart, and this exercise is one way to do that, right? Because you could have been intellectual about it, like mm-hmm. you said, but then when it's like taken away, you feel it. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a comment. I have this too. We do the death meditation here, and the stages of things going away, and it's not as real as something I've written down that is mine.
Mm-hmm.
It's going away.
Yeah. So this really brought it home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was powerful even just reading the story, I have to say. Planners, in my experience, working with hospice patients, often have the hardest time with not being able to control, not being able to plan the way. There's only so much we can plan, right? Challenging.
And one of the things that I thought of, Helen, when you were talking about, you know, this really gives you that sense of, so what's left, right? And when we're doing the 9-point death meditation that's from the Lam Rim, the 3-point version of it, right, is that death is certain, the time is not. The only thing that helps us at the time of death is spiritual practice, right? And so, you know, in a way, a Buddhist version of this would have been to have spiritual practice be the underpinning that doesn't get taken away. But of course, even if you don't have a mind that can practice it, then that becomes a little iffy, right? I mean, if you've got enough habituation, maybe it's still there in some way, but yeah.
And I think one of the things to think about is that the idea of loss, losing access to those things, those qualities in the way that you're accustomed to. They may, as you were, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, in the back, in the vest, yeah. Jeff. We're saying that, I just lost my train of thought, I'm sorry, but that our access to those things is still there, it's just, it's transformed, and then we'll be talking more about transformation and kind of the other side of loss a little bit later in the workshop. Anyone else have any comments or concerns or questions about what this was like for you?
As Venerable Chokyi pointed out, this was a very strong experiential exercise. So I felt a strong sense of grief and loss as it mm-hmm. progressed, but I was also aware of the level of attachment that I have to this physical, this life that I'm living now. And that was eye-opening.
Yeah.
And makes me think about, okay, how am I going to let go in the best way?
So. For you, it sounds like it raised a lot of deep kind of core spiritual questions. Yeah. And this was an experience of incremental, what I would call incremental losses, of course, very different than a sudden loss or a suicide or other types of losses, which have their own, a different type of grief. No better, no worse, just different. And the exercise really, of course, focused on helping you experience in kind of a visceral way the what it feels like to have things that we are attached to be taken from us. They're kind of focused on the harder, more painful feelings. There is another side of grief that I just want to put on the shelf for now because we will be coming back to that. I mean, of course, illness and loss can have unexpected gifts and blessings too. And we didn't focus on that because that wasn't really the focus of this part of the workshop. But they'll become clear as we go along. We're going to move to the whiteboard in just a minute, but I wanted to make sure everyone or anyone who wanted to share had a chance to. Does anyone need a break, or are you okay with moving on? So trying to be good stewards of our time, which is another one of my weak points.
Right. I'd just like to applaud the courage you all had in actually doing this.
Yes.
Because it's one thing to talk about doing it or think about doing it. It's another thing to do it. And you all did it. So,
yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. And I know we kind of delved in pretty deep pretty quickly, too. And
you know me, we got 2 hours. We got to make the most
yeah.
of it.
Yep. Move along. All right. So that activity was from the perspective of someone who's dying, right? And what it's like to be dying and to be losing control, to be losing people and things and ways of being in the world that have been really important and central to who we understand ourselves to be. When someone's dying, that experience kind of has a ripple effect. It affects not just the person who's dying, but obviously anyone who cares about that person, anyone who loves that person, anyone who's in that person's life is also affected. And that we're going to sort of segue into looking at what the experience is like, not from the outside, but from not from the person who's dying, but from the person who's grieving that person who's dying.
Should I pass these out now?
Sure. Yeah, thank you.
It's okay.
Sidetrack. I want you to reflect for the purposes of this whiteboard exercise to really call to mind your own losses. Everybody raised their hand that they had experienced at least one. For many of you, probably way more than one loss of someone important in your life. So you guys are going to help me fill in this chart. And this is a chart that's meant to help us really look at all the different dimensions of the way that grief shows up. We tend to think of grief, if you hear that someone's grieving, you tend to think of, what do you think of when you hear that someone's grieving? What's the first thing that would come to mind? Sorry? Crying? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's certainly a part of the grieving experience. That's why we have tissues in the room and why I have stock and tissues in my office at the work. But grief is much more multidimensional than just tears and sadness. And this is something called a cross pain. I don't know where that term came from, but that's what we call it at our center. It's a sort of a cross pain look at grief and the changes that it can cause for us. So, good question. P-A-N-E, but point well taken. So, don't worry too much about the categories. I'll figure out where they sort of go. But if you guys can help me, think about, you mentioned sadness and tears, so we can go ahead and I would put that under the emotional category.
And can everyone see? If you can't, feel free to move your seat.
Writing is another one of my weak points, so I hope you can read my writing. Okay. What other changes have you noticed for those of you who have lost someone in your life? Other changes have you noticed during that time? Changes in your body. We can start with physical. Can anyone recall any experiencing? Yes.
Absolute exhaustion.
Exhaustion. Fatigue. Yes. Mm-hmm. Very common in grief to just feel drained, completely drained, fatigued, especially for people who've been serving as a caregiver and have been sort of on guard for weeks or months with dispensing medicine or, you know, actively involved in caregiving. And a lot of that sort of adrenaline that you had while the person was living and you were caring for the person is sort of it's depleted after the death. Yes. Yes.
Can you repeat it?
Difficulty sleeping. Yes. Yep. Sorry. Some people sleep too much. Because I consider it a change in your normal routine. Yeah. But it's also could be under physical. Yeah. Yeah. Some people that I see are sleeping, oversleeping, not wanting to get out of bed. Other people can't fall asleep or they're restless. Nighttime, I think, is hard for a lot of people who are processing a loss, you know, when we're not distracted by daytime tasks, nighttime. Anything else? Yes.
Depression, anger, and worry.
Yes. Oh, very good points. Depression, anger, worry. We'll go ahead and put it up there. Anxiety. Relief, yes. Fear, some would say fear.
Foggy mind.
Foggy mind, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say along with that, kind of an all-pervasive, almost numb.
Yes. Don't even really know how you're feeling. Yes. Yes. Numbness and going through the emotion. Was there a critter down there? Okay. In the back, yes. Irrelevance. Loss of meaning. Loss of good one. I'm going to put that right in the core. Yes. Questioning meaning, questioning beliefs that maybe in the past you hadn't questioned. Questioning your purpose. There's a reason this is right in the center. Yeah, this is right in the core. Nothing like losing someone important in your life to raise a lot of really core questions. Yes.
Denial.
Yes. This doesn't seem real. Shock. Yes. Back. Difficulty focusing. Yes. Many of my clients tell me that they love to read, or they used to love to read, but they just can't remember what they're reading. They can't concentrate. They're, you know, reading the same page over and over again. It's just that numbness that you were talking about. Yeah. Or putting the milk in the pantry instead of in the fridge, just disoriented. That's another one I'll go ahead and put up there.
Not eating.
Sorry?
Not eating.
I'll put that under behavioral. Anybody do the opposite? Try to comfort themselves with food? Overeating or comfort eating? I'm sorry? Withdrawal, avoiding people, yes. Put that under behavior. Could have an emotional component to it, too. Just not wanting to socialize, maybe in the same way. Not wanting to be around people. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. They can be, yes, yeah, yeah, you're exactly right. If you've lost a job, if you've lost a relationship, if you've moved to a new town, if you've had a child, you know, that's a loss of a way of life, and that can create all kinds of feelings and changes. That's a good point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Change, transitions, yes. Awareness of your mortality. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
How many people, I think every time I've witnessed someone dying, one of the main topics of conversation was, how old were they?
I think one of the main things I've noticed when other people die, that, I think one of the main things I've noticed when other people have died is that the remaining people seem very concerned about the details as they may apply to them.
Yeah.
What kind of illness was it? And how old were they? And how did they get this? And how long did they have that? And mm-hmm. it may not all get said, but I think everyone tries to relate it to themselves to see, well, how much longer do I have?
Yes, yes. There's a lot of projection, to use a clinical term, that that can happen. Yes.
That's
yeah.
also a Buddhist term.
Yeah,
we're
okay.
doing it all the time.
Good. Children, you see this a lot in a very heightened way with increased awareness of mortality with children who've lost a parent, not wanting to, if mom has died, not wanting to know where dad is all the time, or not wanting to call dad several times a day at school to make sure dad's okay, and just to fear, a recognition that more loss is going to happen. It's sort of a loss of innocence, in a way. Increased awareness of mortality. Yeah, yeah. We do live in a culture of denial. So, yeah. Yes? Helplessness. That is not on here, but it needs to be. Yes. Thank you.
I think also can come the experience of moments of like pristine clarity. Mm. And moments of deep, deep appreciation for the life that is being lived. You know, that day, it may not be all pervasive, mm-hmm. and it may be later in the grief process, but
increased clarity, gratitude,
mm-hmm.
if I can use that word.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the, it's like really shakes you to the core.
Yes,
and,
yes.
Okay, here's what it's really, the real deal. Here's what it's really about. All right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any idea why I put that in a different color? Yeah. 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 I'm sorry. There, in your packet, there is a, I don't want you to look at it too closely because I wanted you to come up with ideas of your own, but there is a pretty comprehensive list of just the whole spectrum of normal, common grief reactions.
And how they're yeah.
Mixed in, yes. It's not an either or. You can feel relief and sadness right alongside each other, and they're not in contrast to each other. That's sort of that duality. You can feel gratitude and sadness at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And often those feelings, as you mentioned, don't always show up right away. You know, it's a process. We'll talk more about process in a bit. We haven't said too much about physical, just a couple of things I wanted to mention there. For anyone who has experienced a loss, what do you remember feeling physically? We've got fatigue, decreased energy. Yes?
I think when you stand up, you just feel yourself kind of slumped over.
Just a heaviness almost that you're describing. I cannot get this cap back on. We'll get it. It's a good point.
There must be stress involved in all this.
Yes. It's stress on your body too, and we often don't acknowledge that. I've had many elderly newly widowed clients who end up in the ER or end up in the hospital soon after their spouse of 50, 60 years has died, and it's a physical stress. Often, sometimes it's panic attack too, but we do a lot of holding, suspending emotions while we're in the midst of caregiving, and sometimes the immune system can really be out of whack when you're dealing with a loss.
The only time I've ever hit another car was the day I found out my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And I just, you know, I shouldn't have been driving.
Yeah. We underestimate, I think, the amount of space that grief takes up in our bodies, in our spirit, and in all aspects of who we are. Yes. Thank you.
The level of loneliness.
Loneliness.
Losing long-term, very connected relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and what they tell me they miss the most is the minutia of daily life, that they're only making coffee for one.
Yes.
You know, I used to hate to do his laundry, but now I miss it.
Yeah.
Those kinds of very ordinary, very predictable things.
Mm-hmm.
I've had widows tell me about just keeping some of the clothes, not just until all the scent was worn out off of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and stuff.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it is a very hard process for a lot of people. Lost my train of thought again. It's often the small things, the things that maybe even in life sometimes drove us crazy, things we end up missing about the person the most.
I think we need to remember this is the culture we live in.
It's so easy to forget the culture we live in.
Mm-hmm.
This past year, you know, I lost a loved one, and I really missed the black outfits that I saw people in Spain wearing when I was there one time. And they, you know, they told me, I said, what are these women clustered in black? What's all that? They look like crows.
Mm.
And they said, no, those are widows.
Mm.
And, you know, they gather in the square and they sit and they're all in black. And everybody knew, because they were all in black, what was going on.
Yeah, an outward sign.
They didn't have to explain themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to talk. People knew.
Right.
And so one is we don't have any of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is we live alone a lot. So we're not in community. Mm-hmm. So when you have a spouse
like Jeanette was saying, and they're gone, and that's it. You're, again, living by yourself. Mm-hmm. So the minutiae of daily life does not, you know, you don't have anything to carry on with because there's nobody else around you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this solo culture we live in and the cultural denial, mm-hmm. even of the outward physical signs, mm-hmm. just wearing clothes. And I remember thinking, I really wish that I could wear black all the time and people would get it without me saying anything.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very strong the way I felt
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. An outward sign, you're talking outward sign of mourning. And
of mourning, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Where
is what I'm going
is,
through,
yeah.
treat with care, you
yes.
know?
Yeah, I have special needs. Yeah. I have special needs. I'm not in an ordinary time.
I didn't have all black clothes on. I didn't go out and buy them. People would have just thought, oh, she likes black. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
I just might make you feel differently.
Oh,
yeah,
maybe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. White. Right, right.
Thank you. In different traditions, such as the Jewish tradition, you sit Shiva for 7 days, and it is respected that you are in mourning. And depending on how the degree of orthodoxy, you would have other traditions after that
mm-hmm.
that are respected by the whole community.
And those rituals, I recently had an Orthodox Jewish man whose wife had died visited me just one time in the office, and he really educated me quite a bit about the importance of those rituals, and they sort of propel you forward, and they give you some grounding through this disorienting time. They can serve a very important purpose, as do, I know, Chuck, you'll probably talk, or some of the other workshops you have, talk more about the rituals that your own spiritual mm-hmm. tradition, they're important.
Yeah, I don't really know what it is, but it's called something. So after a year, after someone mm-hmm. passes, you again visit it, but mm-hmm. you visit it together. And I got to mm-hmm. experience that with a friend whose mother died, and I thought that would have been really helpful for me. I was so young. So, and then every anniversary, I don't know where that fits, but every anniversary, there's kind of relive it all in a minor way again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is very common. We call it an anniversary reaction. Not even anniversaries always, but birthdays or any special events.
Right.
You can expect that kind of heightened resurgence of all these feelings and reliving what's happened.
On a positive note, I was just thinking of another blue word.
Yes.
The motivation. Because if you really are doing the work, as we say, then you can glean something from it to find some motivation about why you appreciated that making the coffee and that you maybe want to make coffee for others, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever way it motivates
mm-hmm.
you.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, is grief even something that, like, we should do? You know, like, I mean, do people feel like, I don't understand how grief fits in, or is it really clear? I'm just curious. Because I think for some people, they think, well, if I'm a good Buddhist, I don't grieve, right? Something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're supposed to take care of ourselves along with others. And if you feel bad, you have to take care of yourself, and some of the teachings would help me, I believe, move on. So using the teachings.
Sure, yeah.
So I wouldn't feel bad about feeling bad.
Yeah. So, Jill said we should grieve shorter. As a joke, yeah.
I one time asked Geshe Sulga about this.
Yeah.
He was one of our earlier teachers. Because I was going through a period of grief. It may have been when one of my parents was dying. And he looked at me and he said, of course you feel sad. Like, why would you think you wouldn't?
Right.
And that really reassured me.
Yeah.
Okay, this is okay to respond this way.
I, I don't ever plant Joanna for her answers, but she always is spot on with us. And, you know, there's this lovely story, I don't know who might have heard it, about MARPA, you know, Milarepa's teacher. And he's instructing all his students about this is all illusion and, you know, don't get hung up. And then his son dies, and he's incredibly sad and grieving. And his students say, but you said it was all illusion. He said, yeah, but this was a great illusion, you know. So, I mean, yeah, big things still affect us, and that doesn't mean we're doing it wrong, right? Yeah.
Venerable Choki, is there a story about the Buddha in which he is walking down a lane and people are coming out of a house, you know, crying, and he is with his followers, and he said, what is wrong? You know, what's going on? And he said, oh, there has just been a death in that family. And he went and started grieving and crying too, you know, with the people who were suffering. But I don't know if I'm mistaken about that or not.
Well, I haven't heard it, but that certainly doesn't mean it's not a true story. And it's a lovely story either way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here I come. Coming. Getting a workout today.
I think for me, there's still a great deal of mystery between our studies and intellectualizing the whole situation, and then boom, something happens. How am I really going to react?
Mm-hmm.
Because
sure.
Even the experiences I've had, I would not have expected the type of reaction that I did have. And I'm sure in a situation where we're very attached, it can be a total surprise. And maybe that's just me and where I am, but I don't know.
I think that's pretty universal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because, you know, like we mentioned earlier today, and that Geshe-la talks about a lot, and Venerable Renee was talking about, you know, there's the intellectual, mm-hmm. but it's getting it to our heart that's what is going to actually transform our mind, right? And we're all in different places on different subjects and being able to really have that true realization, the integration of it versus understanding it intellectually, but then when it happens, we're ill-prepared, right? Yeah, so I mean, I think
how
that's
prepared
universal.
Do we want to be, too?
Well, I mean, you know, I think according to the teachings, the more practice we have with these kinds of things, then that will help prepare us so that we are able to actually react and behave and, you know, all the ways that we want to, you know. But I mean, that's a personal choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone chooses. But, you know, I mean, quite a bit of the teachings are all about really preparing for the moment of death, you know.
I'm trying to be conscious of the time because I know that we're coming actually to the end of the hour a little more quickly than expected. But this has been a really good conversation. I really appreciate you guys helping me fill in the chart. And it's really just meant to illustrate the wide variety of not everybody's going to experience all those things, and certainly not, and there's another little critter down there. Everybody's different in how they respond to grief, and if you take away nothing from my being here, I hope you'll remember and honor that grief is, everybody in this room is different, so how you respond to loss is going to be affected by who you are as a person, where you are in your own life at the time that you lose someone, what kind of a relationship you had with the person who died. What was it, a very intense someone who was in your life every day and just an integral part of your everyday routine, and including the morning coffee together, as someone mentioned? Or was it a more distant, complicated relationship that's going to bring up a lot of more complicated emotions as you make sense of what that relationship was? What else affects grief? What other life stressors you're dealing with at the time? You may not even be able to process your grief if, for instance, if you're I see this a lot with younger women whose husbands die and they've got young children that they're raising. Oftentimes they're so concerned for, someone had talked about thinking of their children, I think person that's holding the microphone. Oftentimes mothers are so consumed with getting support for their children that they don't even really take in how they're responding to the loss. I was 17 when my mom died, and that affected me very differently than my father's still living, that, you know, a very different developmental age than whenever my father dies. And when you lose a parent young like that, you sort of revisit the loss with every milestone you go through, that awareness of the missing person that was supposed to be there for your graduation, your wedding, the birth of your children, all those things. Coming back just briefly to the question of, are we supposed to grieve or do we get to grieve? I wanted to just point out, and we don't have a lot of time to go into it, but there's a really cool thing in your packet called the Mourner's Bill of Rights. I don't know if any of you saw that. I think it's after the grief, the page that has all the grief reactions on it, the Mourner's Bill of Rights. This concept of grieving people having unique rights came from a guy named Alan Wolfelt, who has written a lot of books on understanding grief and loss and lives out in Colorado and has a center out there for loss and transition. The very first right, you have the right to experience your own unique grief and feel a multitude of emotions. You have the right to search for meaning, number 8. And that's right there in the core. Have the right to embrace your spirituality. Some people turn away from spirituality when they're faced with a loss. Other people really lean on that spirituality, and that's what grounds them through the experience of loss. Spend some time with those. I wish we had more time to go over each one individually, but I'm afraid, afraid we don't today. Let's see. I think we can move into the last part. Do you want to start off that part, Chuki, talking about kind of the other side of grief?
Sure, I can kick it off. So, let's see. In our discussion, we had outlined this as sort of the transformative piece or the enduring aspects of relationships or, you know, things along those lines are kind of the final category we wanted to touch on. And really, I think in part it's more blue words, right? Some that are up there and more that we would add if we start thinking that way. And I had a personal story that I was thinking about in terms of this. When my father died, and that's been, I honestly don't remember, I think 8 years ago, my sister and I were very involved with his caregiving in the final 8 weeks or so. And it was pretty intense work. You know, there's just a lot to do. And like so many of these situations, it was exhausting. And, you know, but the real gift, one of the real gifts in it for me was it helped my practice a great deal because I was so exhausted that I had that kind of step back that we strive to find in meditation where I could watch, you know, there's the watcher watching me, you know, and I could see how these emotions would come up, the sadness, it would go down, the anger, up and go down, you know, whatever these emotions were, and I was too tired to attach a story, and it helped me really tease out that these emotions are there without the story. And I always think that they come from the story, but this was a really clear experience through my exhaustion where I was able to see for myself, no, they're just there. And we then build a story around them and think that, you know, that all happens like this normally and we don't realize. And so there were some real gifts to me of being that tired and that emotional that were really reflective, you know. And so there's, I'm sure, a million different versions. Each one of us could name 10 different things that are positive when we go through these difficult situations. But that was one that particularly hit me because it really helped my practice and really helped me truly believe that's true, you know, that that's how it works. I guess particularly in this piece is when I'd remind you all about interdependence, right? I mean, we've talked about that at the beginning, and Jeff made a comment about it. But this idea that any experience that we've been through is going to remain a part of how we're now moving forward, you know. And there's some real, I think, joy and positivity in that. Of course, there's some we can look on and feel like maybe the interaction was not so positive and we incorporated that. You know, it's not all positive, but still there's definitely, you know, we're all going to be different after we leave the room today because of the way we interacted here together, you know. And I think reflection on interdependence can be very helpful during times of loss to think about, you know, what are all the causes and conditions that have come together for this moment, both positive and negative, because you'll find that while the difficult ones are the ones that are so present at that time of loss, you can probably think of a lot more positives that led to the fact that you're clothed and that there's food and you're sheltered, and, you know, I mean, all of those things. So that can be a helpful way, I think, to just work with our own situations if we can remember to do it. That's sometimes the hard part.
I realized I forgot to point out. Can I?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it sort of relates to what you're talking. I think you all got a copy of what we call the grief wheel. And it can be a little overwhelming to look at this in the beginning. I still struggle to fully find the words to explain it, but it really illustrates the concept of grief being a process. You know, a long time ago, I'm sure you've all heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She wrote all these books about grief occurring in stages. Denial, I'm sure you could all say them. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And I'd love to tell you that grief works in a nice linear fashion like that, but the reality is a person in grief can experience denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance all in the course of a day or a couple of hours. Grief doesn't necessarily happen in neat, predictable stages. It's much more of a roller coaster, particularly in the early phases of grief. And one of the things we recognize, or that was pointed out by that first loss exercise that we did, is that grief often, depending on the circumstances, starts well before the person actually dies, right? And you can pass through all those different feelings of denial and anger and all of that, all these things that you see up here, even while the person's still living. But this grief wheel kind of just helps you realize that loss, not just loss due to death, but loss in general is a part of the cycle of life. And it sounds a little bit cliche, but it's really true when you get right down to it. Usually part of my job is to do outreach to any hospice family member who had a loved one who died on hospice care. I do a kind of an introductory phone call about a month after the death to just make sure they're aware of our services and kind of check in with them, see how they're doing, and if there's any support I can offer them. And often in that first phone call, people don't even really know what they need. They're still in that, someone used the word foggy mind. You know what? Don't even really know how I'm doing. I just haven't even really started to process it yet. And that's, you see the word numbness there in that kind of early stage of protest, denial, part of that too. A lot of searching that goes on in the grief process. A lot of times the people that we see are in that, we call sort of the danger zone, where they're kind of stuck in some of these feelings and they haven't really had an outlet to try to make sense out of all that they've been through. Of course, the goal is to get to integration, but you can't really skip through these other areas. I mean, you have to sort of walk through it at your own pace. And in our culture, we want to be able to push the fast-forward button a lot of times and not have to feel the pain of the loss. We want to get right to back to where we were. But we're not the same after a loss, even small losses that are not necessarily death related. We're changed by those experiences in hard ways, in ways we maybe necessarily wouldn't have chosen, but it can also be positive changes too, which comes back to the idea of transformation, unexpected ways that we become deeper people, richer people through these experiences that have become part of who we are. One of my favorite little quotes, or I think it's actually from a poem by Tennyson, is "I'm a part of all I have met." I think it's from Ulysses or one of those old classic poems. But for better or for worse, we're a part of all that we've been through. Probably not by accident that I'm a grief counselor and I had a parent who died at a young age that's now integrated into who I am. And I love working with young adults because I get them in a deeply personal way. I get them.
One of the things I really like about this is it's the grief wheel. It's not the grief spot or, you know,
right.
I mean, there's movement to it, you know, and that whole idea of, you know, there's constant change. It's impermanent. Even the process of the loss has a process. You know, I mean, it's always changing. And Geshe-la has often said, you know, that the definition of blessing is change. You know, and that's sometimes real hard to get at the moment if you're not loving the change at this moment. I haven't heard him say that. So it might not always feel like it, but imagine the opposite, right? I mean, you know, the curse, may you live in uninteresting times, right? Like if things really didn't change at all, what would that be like, you know? I thought it was the opposite, but anyway, we're not gonna sort that out right now. But so set that one aside. But you know, just imagine if things don't change, then there's no opportunity for growth. Or I mean, you know, so we wouldn't want that.
Mm.
It's just we only want the ones we like, and that's completely understandable.
The bidirectional arrows on the grief wheel, since it is a wheel, I'm taking what you said, and I'd like to see Anne's perspective on this from her work, but do people oscillate back and forth around the wheel?
Yes.
Make progress, slip back?
Yes. Yes. And yes. Yeah, and it's often two steps forward, one step back, and often that's the value of a grief counselor, is helping people be able to come and acknowledge progress that they've made and to understand why they may have slipped back on the wheel and what was going on at the time. Maybe there was an anniversary coming up, maybe something, looking at what has triggered different feelings to come up. And often it's worse before it's better. And that's a real hard thing for people to accept, too. Yeah. I wanted to offer a metaphor to illustrate that disorientation searching part. One of the best metaphors I think I've ever come across for the grief process is like trying to figure out a whole new landscape. I don't know if that makes sense, you know, being in a whole different country and it's not familiar and trying to figure out how everything is sort of being realigned and you're in a place of discovery, really. But I don't know if that answered your question. Yeah. A couple of other points are about unexpected gifts. Often, you know, for some of my clients who work with me over a longer period of time, they're in the beginning, they're not able to see all they can see is darkness and what's missing and the loneliness and all those hard emotions. But over time, many of them are able to see their loss in a whole different, broader way and even see some positive elements. I have a woman who lost her husband of 30-something years. I can't remember exactly how many years. And he had been ill for a long time with dementia and kidney disease and, you know, a whole laundry list of debilitating diseases. She had been a caregiver for a long time. And she was talking about how she can't pass by an elderly person now without stopping to talk to that person. And she wishes she could go back in time to have shown more compassion for, she gave an example of being in Disney World and a couple that where one of the man got sick, and then at the time she found herself being sort of repulsed by what was happening, but now she just has a deeper compassion for what that caregiver was, what the wife was going through and what the man himself was going through. And she's doing all this amazing volunteer work. She's reinvesting in life, and she's taking that experience that she had as a caregiver and walking, companioning her husband through the end of life. And her life is now richer in a different way. And I so admire how people find their way through these experiences that we could all end up in the fetal position if we didn't process and find some value, some meaning in the experience. I think if there was anything else I wanted to tell you. Any of you want to share any, and this may be more personal than you're comfortable getting, any unexpected blessings or gifts that you've found through your own experiences with loss? Yes.
I would like to ask, what are some ways in which we can acknowledge a person, especially right after a loss or as they're going through a loss? Because I know so often I hear people say in my own family and friends, oh, that was, you know, like at a wake or, you know, memorial service. It was like, oh, people say things meaning well.
Yes, well intended.
Yes, well intended. So I think I would find it very helpful to hear, you know, the two of you give some suggestions or ideas
for how to support someone who is actively grieving.
Yes.
Is that what you're asking for? Yeah, we could probably spend. Sure. I'll let you have the floor. Sure.
So when I started becoming a hospice volunteer, I took up playing the Native American flute. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll play for the patients, but I always play for the patient and the family when the patient has passed.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing a sermon, just a special ceremony. I don't say a lot. I just say, this is for so-and-so in their transition as they're going through it, and their family, to help them all heal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, to me, that's a way I can do it. And they don't oftentimes know that I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they do, you know, because I'll do it if the person has died, you
sure.
know, there. But I think it's good to actually say, okay, it's all right, this person's gone. There's a lot of grief going on, and it's an honoring, because that's what I do it for, is to just say, this is an honor of so-and-so and their family and all that they're going through and dealing with it.
Sort of marking that transition. Then.
Yeah, and just, you know, saying this is something the person has accomplished as mm-hmm. they have left their life, and that they are making a transition.
Mm-hmm. Very beautiful. Yeah.
When I was much younger, a friend of mine lost his father, and he told me that what helped him the most was people simply acknowledging his loss and not ignoring it. And so I've tried to do that with my friends, and even especially, I have to say, loss of pets, because oftentimes those pets are very, very close to people, and they don't always get acknowledged. So I think that's very important to do.
Sounds simple, but it's amazing how it doesn't happen sometimes. And I think being able to really actively listen, and people generally do want to talk, not always, but you know, giving them that opportunity and space to be able to talk and tell and retell the story. Many people need to. That's part of their way of processing what's happened, is being able to recount the details of leading up to the death. And you know, asking yourself, are you able, am I mentally, emotionally able to sit in that space and take in another person's pain? It's not easy, but it's a real gift. And I think a lot of people that come to the center are just seeking that space, you know, that non-judgmental space to be able to share. There's no magic words. I'd love to give you the Bible of magic words to say to comfort someone. And it's okay to say, you know, I really don't know what to say, and I don't know how you're feeling, and I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I want you to know I'm here. I will make myself available, and you may not want to talk about it right now. Giving people permission to talk about it, and if you ask them how they are, being prepared to listen. Many clients get really frustrated with the question of how are you? Well, how the heck do you think I am? You know, but it's knowing who those people are who, when they ask that question, really, really mean it and really, really want to know how you're doing. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, pretty similar, but, you know, because we all raised our hand about having a significant loss of our own, you know, trying to put yourself as much as you can, if it was a long time ago, it might be difficult. In that situation, what were the comments that were helpful? What were the ones that you got really tired of people asking, even though they meant well? You know, what were the ones that actually made it harder for you, so you had to kind of be tough to tell them you were doing okay? You know, because, of course, each person's going to be different, but in general, I think we're all going to react similarly, you know, to some of those things. And so, you know, I think even little things like, let me know if there's anything I can do to help. Well, that's a fantastic gesture, but it's the rare person who's going to take you up on that. Instead, can I come and do a load of laundry for you? You know, make it concrete, and then it's a lot easier for the person to think, yes or no, do I want that, you know? So there are ways you can, it's the exact same intention coming from your side, but it makes it easier for somebody who's grieving to think through, would that be helpful or not, you know? Because if you've got 10 people who've all said, let me know if there's anything I can do to help, it's pretty hard to reach out to them, you know, unless it's a real close friend or something that you would have called even if they hadn't said that, you know. So I think making it concrete can help.
Also, and I hear this over and over again with clients that, gosh, I have bombarded with offers for help and people to do laundry or meals in the first few months, and now everybody's sort of gone back to their own lives, and I'm still dealing with my grief. Mm-hmm. And remembering the person's birthday or anniversary and dropping them a card on that day, I know this is a hard week for you, or I've been thinking about you. A simple gesture like that means a lot. And remembering that grief doesn't end in a month or 6 weeks, that people still need that support, and they may actually be, and a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that the grief is even more intense at about 3 or 4 month mark. And again, that's not going to be true for everybody. It depends so much on the circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But often, I mean, the majority of the calls that we get are several months out from the loss, or not right after the loss. Yes?
One of the nicest things that anybody said to me after my parents died was when I went back to work, and a really good friend of mine didn't say anything like, how are you doing? He knew exactly how I was doing. He said, it's really great to see you back. Yeah. And that's all he said. And it was really good because it was like, okay, you know, people are thinking about you, but they're not going to say, how are you doing? You're sitting there, your eyes are swollen, you look like crap. And that's exactly how you feel. But to have somebody say, it's great to see you back, even though you look like you've been going through a lot. You know, and that was fun. And then another thing that somebody also did for us, you know, when my parents died, somebody called me up when my friend said, I'm going to Target. Would you like to go? And that was, again, at about, you know, several months out. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful just to know, like, oh, so, you know, it's kind of nice to be remembered. And, you know, it's a really simple thing.
Mm-hmm. I, like you, lost my mother when I was 21. So I was just, it's been hard to think, what did I like? Because I was so young.
Yeah.
But so what I try to do when I, now that it's been so many years, I think I have some perspective when I meet somebody, either our age or somebody younger, when they've grieved, not right away, but to say, this is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look at me, you know, it's okay. Or after the loss of a relationship, like, look at me now, you know, I promise you this is going to change. And, and then offer help along the way. But sometimes I'm bad at just thinking, well, this is the way it is, you know, concrete. So if I think about the fact that it changed for me, then I try to give them hope to say it will change you.
Yeah.
And I'll be here to help you go through it. Yeah. You do have to go through it.
Yeah.
But it isn't always going to feel like this. It's really going to just change and change and change and change.
And that's something that comes out of my mouth a lot, is that, you know, every time I see you, you're going to, I don't know what place you're going to be in, but you're going to be in a different place. So I know you may not believe that right now. But, yeah. Good point, Joe. Thanks.
this is on a different, well, what if the person is getting advice they don't want? Like, you'll feel better when, or something that just doesn't
compute. Is that helpful? Do you guys find that helpful?
Unhelpful, right. I mean, anger comes up. I would imagine, I had someone do something odd when my mother died. And I was able to, practicing here, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't know, I guess, do you give people strength in saying, I've had enough of your advice, please leave me alone?
I think the caveat, Susie, take care of yourself.
Well, I mean, I think you have to assess where you're at, right? Because just because you're grieving doesn't mean you can't try to be a bodhisattva. So sometimes you can say, okay, I'm strong enough today, I can let them do their thing because that's important to them. I don't have to really take it in as solid advice because I think it's crazy. It's not going to help me. But they're getting something from offering this, so I can let them do that. You might have a day, though, where you don't have the capacity to do that, right? And then you can just kindly let them know, I really appreciate that you've got a good intention here, but I'm not in a space to hear this right now.
And that's a good way to say it. Yeah, thank you.
It can be hard to be compassionate and be patient when you're grieving. Impatience or heightened sensitivity didn't make it up onto the board, but that's often something I see with people in the earlier parts of grief, too. But, yeah, coming back to that mourner's bill of rights and that you know, you are the expert on your own grieving process. You may not feel like it, but you get to do this in your own way, and you can take in the support and the well-intended advice of other people, but ultimately you get to decide. Another thing, just one more thing as far as what can be helpful. I often hear stories from clients of things that have been helpful, or often I hear what's been hurtful and not helpful too, but hearing stories about the loved one who has died, getting letters or cards from people maybe they that knew their husband or friend or whoever it was. Maybe they didn't even know that person, but even continuing to learn about the person after they've died and having those on paper and just the legacy idea. Yes.
when my brother died about 9 years ago, that's this woman who, she was a friend of the family, and her kids grew up with us. And what she came to one of the memorial services, and then she just sent a little letter telling a story about him. I always remember Tom doing this, doing that. And that was it. It was like, you know, almost one line, but it was really beautiful to hear a story from her, just from her view, about my brother. It was lovely.
Yeah. It reminded me, I had forgotten about this. I had a Girl Scout friend growing up who was in a hiking accident and died, and her family, I don't know how they had the foresight to do this, but they asked her close friends to write down memories and stories, and I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but it was some stupid story about braiding Megan's hair and slumber parties, but it's one of their greatest treasures to have a, you know, different side of Megan that maybe they didn't get to see.
Well, and what's sweet is when I walked outside, the new garden is going in, and there's a plant out there that has these seeds that are attached, that are carried by the wind. That, you know, there's sort of a fluffy little ball, and there's little seeds. Mm-hmm. That was the story this woman told about my brother, is that she remembers these. We had them on milkweed. I grew up with milkweed, and we would, in the fall, these seeds would go wild, and we'd just rattle them and chase them and run after them, saying, "Come back, come back." So we called them comebacks. So I walked out here after doing something the other day, and I was like, "Oh, comebacks, Tom! Wow, it was just lovely." So this wheel, I was going to say, I almost would pull it out of the page and make a spiral out of it, because to me, things keep coming around. It's not just oscillating back and forth. Probably everybody knows this, but I would pull the wheel out and make it a spiral.
Yes, I've seen more complex versions that do kind of have that spiral.
No, but I almost brought that up earlier, exactly, the spiral notion, because when you come back to it, you're never in the exact same place that you were.
Is this still working? It felt like it went out. Can you still hear me? Okay. We are almost at the end of the hour.
I think we probably need to wrap up. So, so I have a very short poem that I want to read. So it's variously attributed either to Thich Nhat Hanh or to the Buddha. I'm not sure if Thich Nhat Hanh wrote it or if it just appears often in his books and it came from a sutra. So sorry, I tried to track that down before today and I didn't. So, but it's solid either way. This body is not me. I am not limited by this body. I am life without boundaries. I have never been born, and I have never died. Look at the ocean and the sky filled with stars, manifestations from my wondrous, true mind. Since before time, I have been free. Birth and death are only doors through which we pass, sacred thresholds on our journey. Birth and death are a game of hide and seek. So laugh with me. Hold my hand. Let us say goodbye. Say goodbye to meet again soon. We meet today. We will meet again tomorrow. We will meet again at the source of every moment. We will meet each other in all forms of life. So,
seems like a nice way to end.
Yeah.
Yes.
So with that, just want everyone to check in with themselves and see if they're feeling, you know, unsafe, or that this just stirred up too much. Please, please don't leave without talking to one of us. We're both going to be hanging around
for a
while. I'm
not in a hurry to leave, so if you do want to talk further or have questions, I know it's been a heavy couple of hours, but we've had some laughter too, and that's kind of the way it goes with grief. It's, but I really appreciate your being so participatory and so willing to share. So it's been good.
And I'd really like to thank Anne again, because not only does she bring this wealth of professional experience, but she and I have had many conversations preparing for today. She was very interested in trying to create something that would particularly fit our community, and she put a lot of time and effort into today's workshop. So really thank
you. Thank you. Thank you. If you are comfortable and want to, part of my requirement for doing these outreach workshops is to bring along an evaluation form. It's very simple. Would it be all right for me to pass it out?
Sure. Before you do that, let's just do a quick dedication, and then we'll pass that out. Okay?
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Yeah. That's okay. So take just a moment and recall what the motivation you said at the beginning was, and think about that. And just think anything positive that we created here together today in these last 2 hours. Let's bundle all that up and dedicate it for the greatest benefit for all beings. And help us work on our own minds so that we can better serve others and be happier ourselves. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I did not mean to jump the gun on that.
I didn't warn you I was going to do that, so it's okay.
I will pass out the evaluations also. If there's more literature there, there's a card that has information about upcoming workshops. You're welcome to take one of those. And if you are interested in being added to our listserv, please feel free to add your name to our list. Sure.
Yeah, thanks to Susie for being the runner.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And I really do welcome your feedback. I'm, as I said in the beginning, I'm much more of a one-on-one. That's my comfort zone. So I'm really trying to improve my skills at these workshops. And you got one. So I welcome your feedback, the good, the bad.